The Katra Podcast, conversations for the curious, essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Katra AI. Welcome to the deep dive.
If you, like me, sometimes feel just overwhelmed trying to make sense of global conflicts.
Yeah, it's a lot.
Right. From cyber attacks hitting the headlines to these really protracted conflicts playing out. Well, this deep dive is definitely for you. Today, we're getting into Richard English's Modern War, a very short introduction.
And it really is an indispensable guide. It kind of forces you to look beyond the, you know, the immediate news cycle, the flashy technology.
That shiny new toy thing.
Exactly. English's core mission really is to help us decode modern warfare. He argues pretty forcefully that it's just profoundly complex. You can't grasp it by only looking at weapons or tactics.
Right. It feels like an antidote to those really simplistic answers we often get.
It makes you zoom out, embrace this bigger picture, you know, politics, society, the tough ethical questions. So our mission today is tackling that core question English poses. How should we really think about modern war in all its dimensions?
And hopefully we can show you why understanding his framework might mean you never quite look at a news report about war the same way again.
Okay, let's start unpacking this with the author's background, because his perspective, that's really key here, isn't it? Who is Richard English?
So he's a very distinguished historian and political scientist. He's currently professor of politics at Queen's University, Belfast. And crucially, his expertise isn't just in, you know, traditional state versus state wars.
Right.
He's a leading international authority on political violence, terrorism, non-state conflict, especially related to Irish nationalism.
Ah, okay, that's critical, because he's known for works like Armed Struggle,
right,
the history of the IRA.
Right.
And if you're analyzing something like the Troubles, you have to look at political motives, asymmetric warfare. It's not just about tank formations.
Absolutely. And that's what makes his approach so distinctive.
Yeah.
He's not purely a military historian focused only on, you know, generals' decisions and troop movements.
Yeah.
He examines war as this complete social and political phenomenon. He gives real weight to the motivations of insurgents, the historical context, the experience of civilians.
So he's providing more of an analyst's lens, moving beyond the battle map into the why and the what happens next.
Precisely. His lens is wide enough to capture that whole ecosystem of conflict,
too,
which is, well, vital when we try to figure out what war actually is today.
Let's start right there, then. It's a very short introduction, but it packs a real intellectual punch. The basic idea is, to get modern conflict, you need to bring in political science, sociology, ethics, the whole toolkit.
And the cornerstone, the absolute foundation of his argument, goes back to Clausewitz, the classic military thinker.
Right.
War is fundamentally a continuation of politics by other means. Military force, you see, is a tool to achieve a political goal. It's never, or shouldn't be, an end in itself.
I find myself thinking about that line constantly when I read about conflicts. But okay, the tools of war have changed so dramatically, haven't they? Drones, cyber, AI. Does English think that political objective is somehow less important now?
No, actually quite the opposite. He shows that while the tools evolve, the political function, the basic causes, the human experiences underneath it all, those remain remarkably constant.
So if the military action doesn't serve a clear, achievable political goal,
then by his definition, it's essentially a failure. Or worse, just pointless violence.
He traces the start of this modern war era back quite a way to the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars. Why then? What changed?
Well, because those conflicts really introduced the defining features of mass warfare as we know it.
Mm-hmm.
You had the rise of aggressive nationalism,
okay,
state-led ideology, and this new ability for the state to mobilize its entire population for war.
Mm.
And that led directly to the concept of total war, where that line between the soldier on the front and the civilian back home just starts to erode.
Critically eroded, yeah.
It really cemented the state as the central manager of organized violence.
It's fascinating how he weaves together centuries of conflict, and he keeps coming back to that paradox, right? The super high-tech precision warfare existing right alongside unbelievable, almost primitive brutality.
Yeah, it's a very sobering reality check, especially for anyone who thinks technology somehow sanitizes war. It really doesn't.
Let's dive deeper then into the nuts and bolts of the book, starting with the causes of war. English uses that classic three-level framework, which I found really helpful for organizing things. Can you walk us through those levels?
Sure. And the key thing he argues is that it's almost always a combination, not just one level. So the first, the lowest level, is the individual level.
Okay.
This looks at, you know, basic human nature, aggression, fear, misperception, or sometimes the ambition, the ego, the calculations of specific leaders.
Mm.
Think of a dictator deciding to invade based on paranoia, perhaps.
Right. Then you move up to the state level. What's that cover?
That involves domestic factors within a country. Things like aggressive nationalism, economic struggles over resources, maybe internal instability that a leader tries to fix by, you know, starting an external conflict.
Exporting the problem.
Exactly. Or even the type of government. Is it a fragile dictatorship that needs an external enemy to survive?
Mm-hmm. And the final level.
That's the highest level.
Yeah.
The international system level. This is where big concepts like international anarchy come in.
Which doesn't mean chaos.
No, not chaos in the everyday sense. It means the absence of a global government, a world police force. So because there's no higher authority, every state feels it has to rely on itself for security, a self-help system.
And that defensive buildup leads to the classic security dilemma.
Precisely. State A builds up its defenses, just trying to feel secure. But State B sees that buildup and feels threatened, so it increases its defenses.
Which makes State A feel less secure.
Prompting State A to build up even more. It's this dangerous feedback loop, driven by mistrust in a system with no overarching referee.
The big insight here, which English really hammers home, is that most wars are this toxic cocktail. You've got factors from all three levels mixing together.
Absolutely. You can't just pin the start of a major conflict, say, in Ukraine, purely on one leader's ambition. You have to factor in historical nationalism at the state level and those big security concerns within the international system.
Which brings us neatly to the conduct of war. Chapter 3 gets into the central paradox of modern conflict. We hear constantly about the revolution in military affairs, RMA.
Right, the drones, satellites, AI, all promising precise, clean, almost surgical conflict.
But English argues the dominant reality on the ground is often the complete opposite, asymmetric warfare.
Yes. This is where the world's most technologically advanced powers find themselves constantly challenged and sometimes even defeated by non-state actors, insurgents, guerrillas, terrorist groups.
Like the U.S. in Vietnam or the Soviets and then the U.S. in Afghanistan.
Those are classic examples. And English, drawing on his expertise in political violence, really stresses how these weak actors can win. It's often through low-tech, adaptable methods, think IEDs, improvised explosives, and crucially by having or building greater political legitimacy and popular support among the local population than the superpower they're fighting.
So the lesson is pretty stark. Technology doesn't guarantee victory. Political will, local backing, adaptable strategy, those seem far more decisive than just having the fanciest weapons. It's like David versus Goliath, but David knows the terrain and has the village cheering him on.
That sums it up well. Yeah. And this flows directly into Chapter 4, which deals with the human experience of war. And honestly, this is probably the most poignant part of the book.
Yeah.
English insists we have to move beyond the general's map, the abstract strategy, and confront the terrifying reality. For the individual.
For the combatant, it's not just about physical wounds, is it? It's that complex psychology, the camaraderie, the sense of mission, sure, but also the sheer fear, the moral injuries from making impossible choices, and the long shadow of trauma, like PTSD. These are people, not just units on a map.
And then there's the non-combatant, the civilian, who, in modern war, is so often the primary victim, even the primary target.
Because that line is so blurred now.
Critically blurred. Thanks to concepts like total war, strategic bombing, sieges, English highlights the immense suffering, displacement, starvation, loss. But he also points out civilian resilience and agency. They aren't just passive victims. They're actively trying to survive, to resist, to cope.
That ethical focus really sets the stage for the next difficult topic, how wars actually end. Chapter 5 makes a key point. Modern wars rarely conclude with that clear-cut victory parade and surrender ceremony, like, say, World War II.
No, they really don't. More often, they kind of fizzle out. They turn into frozen conflicts, uneasy ceasefires, or they require these incredibly messy, drawn-out political negotiations.
So a military win doesn't necessarily mean you've actually won the conflict.
Not in English's view. The only way to truly win is by achieving a sustainable political settlement, something that actually addresses the root causes of the conflict.
Which explains perfectly why the swift military victory in Iraq back in 2003, for example, didn't lead to lasting peace.
Exactly. The political challenges, the task of building a stable settlement, were far, far harder than the initial military operations. It's a textbook case for the primacy of politics.
So chapter 6 then looks ahead to the future of war. We've had this period, the long peace, with fewer major wars between big states since 1945. But that's countered by other persistent threats, right?
Yes. Key trends he points to include the continued, maybe even growing, prevalence of civil wars and insurgencies. And then there are two major new domains emerging.
Oh, wait.
First, cyber warfare. That's the newest frontier, targeting everything from power grids to financial systems. And second, the rise of the gray zone.
The gray zone. What exactly does he mean by that?
It's that murky space between declared peace and open warfare. It involves things like economic pressure, state-sponsored disinformation campaigns, funding proxy groups, cyber intrusions.
So things that are hostile but don't necessarily cross the threshold into traditional armed conflict.
Precisely. It means peace and war aren't always distinct states anymore. They can be continuous, happening at the same time. Hmm. It's this persistent, low-level, often deniable confrontation.
It makes his final assessment feel quite sobering. That war, in some form or another, just remains this persistent, evolving feature of human affairs.
Yeah. But what English does brilliantly is synthesize it all. He structures the book around these maybe three core themes that really force you to look critically at how war is discussed.
Okay, let's unpack those themes. The first, and it feels like the most fundamental one, is war is fundamentally a political and social act.
Right. If a military action doesn't serve a clear political purpose, it's just violence for violence's sake. It has to be judged by the political outcome it achieves or fails to achieve.
The second theme you mentioned is the paradox of modernity.
Yes. This is about being really skeptical of what you might call techno-determinism. The idea that the latest gadget, AI or hypersonic missiles, is going to be the decisive factor.
Because
English shows that while these high-tech tools exist, conflicts are still often decided by low-tech brutality, think of machetes or IEDs, and by human factors like motivation, ideology, political organization. Technology matters, but it's not everything.
And the third key theme, the blurring of lines.
Mm-hmm. The battlefield isn't just over there anymore. The gray zone means peace and war bleed into each other. And critically, the civilian is now right at the center of the battlefield, making that old distinction between combatant and non-combatant often tragically irrelevant.
Those are powerful themes. And he uses some really memorable lines or core ideas to drive them home, doesn't he?
He does. They act almost like anchors for his arguments. Let's look at maybe three core ideas that really capture the book's essence.
Okay, first one, reinforcing that core Clausewitzian idea. War must always be understood as a continuation of politics by other means. Military action without a political strategy is destined to fail.
Yeah. That single idea forces you immediately to ask, what's the political goal here? Rather than just focusing on tactical wins or losses.
It reframes everything. Okay, the second one.
This one directly challenges that tech focus.
Mm-hmm.
The future of war is not just about hypersonic missiles and artificial intelligence. It is equally about the persistent, no-tech brutality of the improvised bomb and the power of ideology.
It's a reminder that human will, human belief, is still the engine of conflict.
Exactly. And the third one brings in that crucial human ethical dimension. To truly comprehend war, we must move beyond the general's map to the terrifying reality of the individual, the soldier's fear, the civilian's loss.
Ensuring the human cost is never just seen as, you know, collateral damage.
Right. It insists on keeping the suffering front and center. And taken together, these ideas give you that framework for critical thinking. When we ask, why didn't the military success in Iraq in 2003 lead to political stability? English's framework gives you the answer. The political strategy didn't match the military one, and it failed to account for the power of the insurgency's motivation and the complex social reality.
So let's bring it home for the listener. How does reading this book, understanding these ideas, actually change how you engage with the world? What are the kind of real-life applications?
Well, first and foremost, it helps you become a much more informed citizen, a more intelligent consumer of news about conflict.
Oh, so.
It teaches you to ask tougher questions. When you hear about a military strike, instead of just asking, did it hit the target? You start asking, okay, but what's the sustainable political goal here? Who has local support? What does a stable end state actually look like? And is this action helping or hindering that.
That's a really powerful shift in perspective. It's essentially a masterclass in critical thinking and media literacy when it comes to war.
Absolutely. It helps inoculate you against those overly simplistic, sometimes jingoistic narratives. You become much more skeptical of any claim that, you know, this new weapon or that tactic alone is going to win a war or solve a deep political problem like nationalism or resource competition.
And there's an emotional or empathetic dimension too, right?
Definitely.
Yeah.
By focusing so much on the human experience, the soldiers' fear, the civilians' loss, the complex motivations on all sides, it encourages a deeper sense of empathy. It pushes back against the dehumanization that so often happens in conflict coverage. You start seeing the people involved, not just labels or statistics.
For me, I think the most valuable lesson is just how central that complexity is. You can't simplify war without distorting it. And that core message, military force is just a tool. The primacy of politics is everything. If the political strategy is weak or flawed, no amount of military brilliance can guarantee success.
I agree. And what really struck me, what I found most maybe surprising or illuminating, was the clarity on that paradox of asymmetric warfare. The idea that the most technologically advanced military can still be stymied, even defeated, by a weaker but more politically astute adversary.
Yeah.
That focus on political legitimacy and popular will, often trumping sheer firepower, fundamentally changes how you assess power dynamics on the global stage. It's not just about who has the biggest budget or the fanciest jets.
A truly indispensable guide, then. A fantastic deep dive into, well, an inescapable and profoundly complex part of our modern world. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.